Well, let's talk about your new book. This is really a gripping thriller. You know, I literally could not put this book down.
Oh, good.
Read until about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I was all but, I think, an eighth of the way finished. And I woke up first thing in the morning and finished it.
Oh, good. I'm delighted.
I'm just sorry I had to go to sleep in the middle of it. But that's a sign of a novel that really holds your attention. Did you ever read a book called The Minds of Billy Milligan by Dan Keyes?
The Billy Milligan case was one of the ones that I researched preparing to write about multiple personality disorder. I don't know if I read the book, but I read a lot of news clippings about his case. In fact, I sort of referred to him without naming him in one of the scenes toward the end of the book where the lawyer is telling Laurel that, don't worry, you know, I've done my homework and you won't have to do any time in prison. And he mentions a case in Ohio where a man abducted, raped, and robbed 3 co-eds and was found not guilty because one of his other personalities did it, not he. And that was the Milligan case I was thinking of at that point.
Yeah, the listeners should know that one of the characters has multiple personality disorder. Is that the term?
Yeah, and I sort of wanted to use her, Laurel, with her multiple personalities as a metaphor for Miami, because Miami, I wanted to make Miami one of the main characters in the book, because I love the city and it's so fascinating. And Miami is a city of multiple personalities. You know, it's so beautiful, yet can be so deadly, like Laurel. And it can look so innocent and yet be corrupt, you know, like little Jennifer, one of the other personalities. And sometimes it's a city totally without conscience, like Alex, and full of people obsessed about one thing or another, like Harriet, the homemaker. So I wanted to sort of draw that, have the villain reflect the city.
Well, it should be noted that we don't want to spoil the ending, of course, but the identity of the killer who commits a series of murders is revealed fairly early on in the book, so we're not giving away that much. And then,
right.
Of course, the interesting thing, and we know that the killer is living with the homicide detective, Rick, who is investigating the case. So we know that somewhere along the line, Laurel, the killer, is going to turn on Rick. It's just a matter of time. We just don't know when and how. So the suspense really builds in Nobody Lives Forever. Why did you decide to turn to fiction from nonfiction?
Because fiction was my first love. You know, I was hooked on stories as a small child because my mother read to me. And even before I knew how to read, when people asked me what I was going to be when I grew up, I always said I was going to write books. And I meant fiction. And I'm really blessed because how few of us ever get to grow up and do what we wanted to do as little children. And I didn't intend to be a journalist. I had no ambitions. I didn't study journalism. I sort of fell into journalism. It was an accident. And I've never done fiction before, although I've been accused of it a few times. And it's really exciting and wonderful to be able to do this. In many ways, it's more satisfying in journalism because there's so many cases. You know, as writers, we like to be tidy and wrap up all the loose ends. And in journalism, most often that doesn't happen. You have the never-solved murders, the missing people who are not found, the unidentified corpses that you never can get back home. You never identify them. And so this way, the writer is in charge in fiction, and you can solve all the perplexing mysteries and write your own ending, and it's really much more satisfying in a way. I loved it.
Well, it should be noted that you are a longtime crime reporter for the Miami Herald.
Right.
How did you get into, you said you fell into journalism. How did that happen?
Well, I moved down to Miami, and I needed a job.
From where?
From Paterson, New Jersey.
Mm-hmm. What were you doing in Paterson?
Well, I was working
living there.
Yeah, I was working for Western Electric, and my mother and I vacationed in Miami, and I instantly fell in love with it and knew it was exactly where I belonged. And so came to Miami, and as I mentioned in my last book, which was sort of autobiographical about what it's been like covering crime in Miami for the last 20 years, the corpse had a familiar face. I told how, you know, we escaped from Paterson, New Jersey, and got down there. And Western Electric there wouldn't hire us. They had a policy that they wouldn't hire someone from another plant because, of course, everybody in New Jersey would then want to come to Florida. So, you know, it made sense. So I was looking for a job. And meanwhile, I joined a creative writing class and one of the other students was a newspaper editor for a small paper in Miami Beach. And he suggested that I come over there and apply for a job, and that was how I got into journalism. And then eventually, 5 years later, got hired on by the Herald. So it was all an accident. It was totally unplanned. And in the back of my mind always was the fact that I loved fiction. It was what I loved to read and what I had always wanted to write. And it was sort of tough because I had to convince Random House that I could write a novel. They immediately wanted me to write the nonfiction sequel to The Corpse Had a Familiar Face. And they were sort of resisting when I kept saying I wanted to write a novel. And finally I cornered my editor and said, why? And he said, well, when somebody's noted for playing the violin, you have to have reservations when they announce plans to play the tuba. But finally I convinced them that I could play the tuba, went home to do it, and then really panicked because Ernest Hemingway said once that anybody that writes novels should work first for a daily newspaper, but never for more than 18 months. And I'd sort of overdone it by a couple of decades. So I was really concerned. In the first few chapters, the first two or three chapters, I struggled, and I kept looking over to one side for my notebook, and of course it wasn't there. You know, a journalist always has their notebook right at their side. And then something wonderful happened along around the third or fourth chapter. The characters just suddenly came to life and took on lives of their own and did and said things that I never would have dreamed. Laurel, the villain, became far worse. I mean, she was really bad. Far worse than I ever dreamed she'd be. Jim, who was supposed to be a minor character, became much stronger and almost took over the book. And my cat Flossie sits on my lap when I work. And it's better than having worry beads, having a cat to stroke, and she watches the cursor as I work on the word processor. And sometimes I would just say, Flossie, my God, look what she's doing now. The villain was doing such terrible things. And it was really fun to just finally be able to let your imagination take flight and soar without having to worry about live people, about their lawyers, about libel laws, and just do it and let the characters tell their own stories. And it was fun.
There's a big difference of opinion about creative writing and journalistic writing. There is quite a difference. Some people, as Hemingway remarked, think it's a good thing. In fact, well, I mentioned William Kennedy. He was a long-time newspaper writer. Still, there's another area of thought that people who go to the writing workshops, creative writing workshops and colleges and so forth, shouldn't get involved in journalistic writing because it's too spare.
Yeah, too synoptic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't think you can, when you come to writing, I don't think you can make rules, can you?
That's right. I think everybody has to do it their own way. And, I mean, some writers still write longhand standing up on big, long yellow pads, but it works for them. So, I don't know, but I think it was very exciting, and it was quite different because than journalism where you're relying on facts and have to have everything exact. You can just sit there, and in some scenes that were exciting, I was sitting on the edge of the chair, Flossie and I, because we weren't sure what was going to happen next. It was like unfolding in my mind like a movie, and it was really exciting and fun. And it was different also that with nonfiction, with the nonfiction books that I've done, you could sort of put it away and walk away from it and then go back and take up where you left off. But I found I was a lot more reclusive when writing the novel, that when I did see my friends, they quickly got very tired of me because all I could talk about was the characters in the book. You have to reach more inside yourself instead of relying on outside stimuli. And so it was harder. Like, I didn't want to be interrupted by anything. I couldn't see a movie. I didn't want to go out to dinner. I didn't want to watch anything on television. I didn't want anything to interrupt my train of thought because the characters were alive, and I was sort of living their lives out in my mind, and it was a whole different thing.
Yeah, you kind of get possessed, don't you?
Yeah, yeah, and imagine it. It took me a year to write it. Imagine if I was one of these writers where they worked for 7 or 8 years on a novel. I can't imagine living that way for that long, just so totally taken up and consumed by your story and your characters that you can't talk about anything else, and you can't really get involved in anything else because they're always on your mind.
In fact, Thomas Sanchez, who lives in Key West, wrote a wonderful novel called Mile Zero about Key West, Florida.
Yeah.
And he claims to have spent 12 years on that book, although there were things that happened to him, and he went bankrupt and lost his house to the IRS, and a lot of things happened to him. But he said one of the reasons he lost his house was he kept making additional mortgages and withdrawing money from it in order to finance his writing career.
Yeah, it's not easy.
Because he didn't have another job. So it was tough. But essentially, he says, in the 12-year period that he worked at Mile Zero, that was what he did. You know, that is a long time when you think about it. But it's a
and it was worth it. It's a wonderful book.
Did you read it?
I've read parts of it. I haven't finished it yet, and I didn't want to carry it on the planes with me because it's too big.
It is big. It really captures the atmosphere of Key West, I think.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Miami and your work as a crime reporter. How did you land the crime beat anyway?
Well, that was another accident because at the small paper that I worked at first, I did some of everything. You know, I covered politics, did some police stories, did celebrity interviews, wrote a column. I even picked the dogs for the sports department because it was a very small staff. And sometimes had to write the letters to the editor because nobody else wrote. And then at the Herald, the first year I was there, I was general assignment. The second year I covered criminal courts, and I came off the criminal court beat realizing that there were a lot of incredible stories in court that we'd never covered when the crime occurred, that we were somehow missing these cases. And I could see also that the crime situation was not about to get any better in Miami. If anything, it would be worse. So I suggested to the editor that someone make a beat out of it, that somebody should go to at least the three major police headquarters every day, rap with the troops, read the reports, you know, try to, you know, see what's going on, stop by the morgue in the jail and see who came in overnight. And without skipping a beat, he was not one of these editors that needs to call a lot of meetings before making a decision. Without skipping a beat, he said, sounds good, do it, and walked away. And I was standing there sort of stunned and panicky. I wasn't volunteering. I was suggesting somebody should do this, but not necessarily me. In fact, I was the last person I wanted to see do it. But I did, and it became a beat, and that's what I've been doing ever since.
I read in some of the publicity material that you have covered something like 4,000 murders.
I've covered about 5,000 violent deaths, about 3,000 of them murders. The rest were, you know, suicides, accidents, natural disasters, plane crashes, building collapses, things like that.
Do you recall your first violent death? How did that affect you?
Yeah. You know, it was really interesting. I'll never forget it. It was an electrocution, and I was at the paper, and they said that a man had been electrocuted on the roof of a building nearby. So I ran over there and ran up the stairs. They were building a second floor onto a little market there. And this man was a construction worker who'd been up there. And he had a hard hat on, but he was standing on a ledge and sort of backed into a high-voltage wire. It caught him on the back of the neck and the shoulder. And he pitched forward and then was impaled on one of the spikes that they had coming up to sort of hold the second floor that they were going to build. So I ran up there, and I also took pictures at the time. I was a photographer. So I took pictures and, you know, tried to figure out how it happened and talked to the people there, and the medical examiner came. That was the first time I met one of the medical examiners. And when they finally removed him and brought him down onto the floor, actually the roof, he was about 23 or 24, and he was married and had three children. And he looked so young and strong and virile. You know, he was dressed in jeans and had a shirt on, had a great tan. And it was in May, I think, and the breeze was blowing and his hair was sort of riffling in the wind. And he looked so alive still. And it seemed so wrong, so outrageous, that when he left home that morning, his family never knew or suspected that they wouldn't see him again. And it really made a deep impression on me. It always is so painful to see people dead too soon. And sensitive reporters, a good reporter is always outraged by things that are wrong, by the plight of the little guy who's wronged, and there's no greater wrong than being dead too soon. And that sort of made me sensitive. It's always horrible when somebody is out there trying to make a living and is killed either in an accident or in a convenience store robbery. They get shot, or a cab driver gets shot. And I think that was what made me fascinated with it in the first place, how this accident happened, why. And I've been fascinated by the beat ever since.
Well, I have a long history as a general assignment reporter myself, and I've seen a certain degree of violence, certainly not as much as you have. But I always found myself caught up in the logistics of covering the story, because I would normally do it for radio or television, and trying to get a camera in or a tape recorder, getting sound was something that we always needed to do, for trying to find a telephone to get it back to the station.
Yeah.
And so usually I'd be so busy, I remember covering a terrorist bombing at France's Tavern in downtown Manhattan, and a number of people were killed. And I remember walking across this rubble, and there were bodies and body parts and everything. And I didn't even think about it. I was thinking, where the hell am I going to get a telephone to get this back in? So it's later that it seems to sink into me.
Yeah, I know. I never really had time to be squeamish or frightened, because all you're thinking about is that deadline. Like, all you were thinking about is getting your story back to home base. And I'm always thinking about the deadline. It's coming at you like an avalanche. Nothing can stop it. And so you've got to get your story. And things that if they happen to you in your personal life or on your day off, might really, you know, send you into a tailspin. You're not, because you're like a person obsessed. You're just thinking about getting the story, meeting your deadline. And then even the next day, you don't have time to think about how awful it was or how frightened you should have been or how much danger you might have been in, because tomorrow there are new deadlines and you're working against 3 or 4 or 5 deadlines a day, and it's 7 days a week. The newspaper doesn't stop. So in a way, that's sort of a safety net that you never have time to realize how dangerous things can be or how terrible they might be, because you're too busy doing the job. It sort of wraps you in a cloak of invincibility.
Yeah, I remember covering a suicide. The United States Attorney for the Eastern District jumped out of the window of his apartment building in Brooklyn Heights, and it was about an 8-story building. And I remember going over there and covering the story. And when I got there, they had covered the body with a sheet, but a lot of blood had come out and it had run down the sidewalk and into the gutter. And there again, I was running around trying to talk to neighbors and talk to the police and trying to find a telephone and get the story back. And later when I got home that night, I began to think, gosh, how red that blood was. I could not believe the contrast of that blood. A pool of blood, almost like a lake on the sidewalk and running into the street. It was so red against the pavement.
Yeah.
And I couldn't stop thinking about that all night. And yet at the time, I was so busy, I didn't think about it. I was completely aloof. It could have been a dummy under that blanket. You know what I mean? And then later it all...
These little things come back to you later. Yeah. How sometimes, you know, a person is just smashed like an eggshell and yet their watch is still ticking. And often the impact when they land, because I've covered a lot of jumpers, you know, their shoes come off. And they're perfectly tied and they're somewhere else. They come off on impact. And things like that, they do tend to haunt you.
Tell me about Miami. It's been many years since I've been to Miami, but I've heard so many bad things in terms of the crime and the violence in Miami. It must be one of the murder capitals of the nation today.
Oh, I love Miami. It's wonderful. It's a great place to be a writer. And I'm very optimistic. The crime rate now is lower. There are fewer murders. I think for the first time, all our crimes are down and dropping. I think for the first time since the 1981, when we broke all the records, other cities have now a higher murder rate per capita. And I think murder is a good barometer of what's happening in a community. It reflects what's going on in a city. And we're having far fewer sophisticated, big drug killings. The drug killings we're having now tend to be more the work of street punks fighting each other, often with these drive-by shootings. Unfortunately, they're notoriously poor shots. And about 60% of the time, they miss their intended target and hit somebody else. But good things are happening. We've got Noriega in jail. We're extraditing the Colombians. We've got a lot of law enforcement in Florida now sent there because of our geographic location. And for the first time, there are some new aids in police work that are being put to use. For years, there was nothing new in police work since walkie-talkies were introduced and bulletproof vests. But now, we've got these sophisticated computers and lasers and DNA typing, which is putting a lot of rapists and other criminals in jail. There's talk now even of DNA testing, fingerprinting, similar to fingerprint records, every jailed rapist. And these fingerprint computers statewide, they can now identify somebody, if he's ever been arrested before, by a single or even a partial print. This is, of course, the way the public believed it always was, but that's not so. Before, you needed a full set of prints, you needed somebody to hand search, but now these computers are making it much quicker and easier to track somebody's identity. And I think, too, it sounds like an oversimplification to tell people not to use drugs, but I think we're beginning to see some results. I've seen a lot of young people lately are taking strong stands against drugs, and I think we're also beginning to see the results of integration in our schools. I think a lot of the kids, the young people, can teach us a lot about tolerance and acceptance. So overall, I'm optimistic, although we still have a long way to go because we've still got refugees from everywhere pouring in there. In the early days when I first went to Miami, and it was sort of a sleepy resort city that was closed down during the off-season, we still had bizarre crime there because when you look at it on a map, you see where Miami is, and it's just sort of everybody on the run from the law or from their own personal demons or from someone else would eventually wind up there. And so a lot of bizarre things happened even then, but of course now they're far greater in number, and we have refugees coming from the south too. And so they're all sort of meeting in Miami, and that's why I think a lot of the crime tends to be so bizarre. But it's beautiful. I guess I love it in a way, perhaps for more for what it used to be. And it never will be that again, of course, but I think it still is going to be something wonderful. It's intriguing. It's like an exotic foreign capital.
Yeah, what struck me the first time I saw Miami was its whiteness. All of these buildings, I never saw white skyscrapers, but they were all so white and shimmering under the sun. What about these Cubans from the boat lift? I noticed that the mayor of Mount Vernon, New York, which is a small town in Westchester near the Bronx line, complained that the crime rate shot up overnight because of the influx of these Cubans.
Yeah, the Mario refugees.
Yeah.
Well, I sort of wish we could buy them all one-way Greyhound bus tickets to Plains, Georgia, because Jimmy Carter let that happen to us. And think how wonderful it would be if we could take all of the career criminals in prison, empty the death rows, empty the hospitals for the mentally criminally deranged, and send them all off to some place where they're welcomed and turned loose on the street with innocent citizens. And that's exactly what happened. Jimmy Carter let Fidel Castro flush his toilets on Miami. He was delighted to get rid of all these people, the troublemakers, the transvestites that were jailed for other, you know, for crimes in Cuba, all the sex offenders, the people, the hardcore criminals, the people on their version of death row. He sent them all to Miami. And so, although there was on the Mariel boat lift, you know, included, there were some decent people, some hardworking people, still, he sent all the criminals. So for a while there, and many of them were the most ruthless criminals that had ever been seen in Miami. I mean, they would just kill people in a bar for no reason to see who was more macho, and they were sort of proud of going to jail. And the worse the crime, the more macho they felt. And it was really horrific there for a while. Now, of course, they've dispersed all over the country. Some of them are in jail, but I'd love to see us be able to somehow send a lot of those people back.
Well, what about your future? Are you going to stick with the crime beat?
Yeah, I'm doing the sequel to The Corpse Had a Familiar Face now. The working title is Never Let Them See You Cry, which is a line that appears once or twice in The Corpse Had a Familiar Face. And I have four novels in mind that I want to write later. But I do miss the daily interaction with my sources, the good creative people in the newsroom, and the excitement of gathering the news, being the first to know it and putting it together for the public. So I will be going back to the police beat.
Are you on a leave of absence?
Yeah, I took a leave of absence to write Nobody Lives Forever, and now I'm extending it to do the first draft of the next book.
Well, for the nonfiction stuff, what do you do? Keep your clips?
Yeah, and do a little research, and I have a lot of my old stories and clips and memories and people that I want to go talk to, and it's going to be a fun book to write. I think it's going to be a good book, but
it's going to be hard to throw anything away, isn't it, to have to keep all that research material?
Yeah, I'm drowning in a sea of paper, as you know, like most writers do.
What about Rick? Is he going to return in a novel?
He may sort of resurface later in one of the novels that I plan to do later on. He won't be a policeman anymore, but he might be a private detective or an insurance salesman.
Kind of sorry you killed Jim off.
Yeah, yeah. He was a good character. I was attached to him.
Yeah, and I won't say this on the air because it's too close to the end of the book, but I figured at one point Jim was all cops are tempted. There are these temptations, and many of them succumb to this temptation, and Jim succumbed.
Especially when they realize they're dispensable people. that the system and the politicians and the people running the police departments consider them disposable.
Nobody Lives Forever, that's a terrific book. Edna Buchanan, thank you very, very much.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you liked it.